أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، باعث الأنبياء والمرسلين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد. وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين المنتجبين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين، روحي وأرواح العالمين لتراب مقدمه الفداء، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين إلى قيام يوم الدين. For the hastening and the return of our Imam, please recite the salawat. First, as we have been doing, we're going to address a couple of rulings pertaining to fast in this month of Ramadan, to remind those of us who have heard these before, in case they've forgotten some of the details, and also to inform those who haven't heard. We talked about pretty much the main items that we've got to abstain from and refrain from in the month of Ramadan. What I'd like to talk about tonight, very briefly, are two exceptions, or two of the exceptions that we have with regards to fast. When the month of Ramadan comes around, it becomes wajib for people to get engaged with fasting. Obviously, we know that. There are a few exceptions. One of the exceptions we've already talked about. One of the exceptions is the exception of a person who's traveling. And we talked about that, I believe, the first night that we started to talk about the issues related to travel and the issues related to fasting. When we started that, we discussed that particular exception. There are other exceptions. I want to speak of two that are similar but slightly different. What are they? One is with regards to someone who has an illness. And because of the illness, there is fear of harm. Okay? Because of the illness, there's fear of harm. These words are carefully chosen. The Maraja choose these words very carefully. We didn't say, for example, that we know that there's going to be harm. All right, we know that there's going to be harm. We didn't say that. We said that they say there's fear of harm. What does that mean? That means that a person needs to have the understanding that there is a good chance, there is a probability of some sort, that if I fast because of the illness, I will be harmed. There's a probability, there's not certainty. The doctor doesn't need to tell you that if you fast, you will definitely get harmed one way or the other, which I'll explain what that harm is going to be briefly. So fear of harm, the fear part we're explaining. You don't have to be sure that it's going to harm you. Fear of harm. Now, one thing about that fear, after understanding the difference between us saying there's fear of harm and saying that there's certainty that there will be harm, fear of harm could have various sources, various reasons. Sometimes a person may have fear of something without any reason, without any legitimate reason. I don't know if you've seen people like that. I've seen plenty of them. There's fear of something, fear of fainting, fear of, I don't know, dying of hunger or thirst, fear of something. There's fear, but there's no legitimate reason. When you explain why you fear, anyone who hears it, like, are you kidding me? Are you serious? There's no legitimate reason. What's a legitimate reason to fear? For example, an expert, a physician, a doctor tells you that if you do this, there's a probability, if you don't eat for this many hours a day, or if you don't drink, or if you don't eat or drink for this many hours a day, then that means there's a probability that something serious is going to happen. Or if you're going to do this over every day for the course of a month, or over the course of a month, then this is going to affect your health. You're going to get either more ill, or you will not be able to recover from your illness, and so on, which I'll explain when we're explaining harm. So fear of harm has to be founded. There needs to be some reason for it, not just out of the blue, I just have a feeling, I'm afraid it's going to have this effect. No, there should be a legitimate reason for that fear. And that legitimate reason can be the opinion of an expert, of a physician, a doctor of some sort. What is the harm? The harm is either the illness getting worse, another illness or an illness developing. Maybe one is weak, and if they don't eat for that many hours a day, what it's going to cause is that it's going to cause an illness. I've heard just recently, I had an experience with that. There was a child that had some form of I don't know if it was a nutritional problem or what it was, but he wasn't gaining enough weight. And if he would fast and not eat for that many hours a day, it would cause him to, over time, develop illnesses, many of them, and therefore the doctor had said it's not wise for him to fast. There's fear of that. So developing an illness, number one. An illness that we already have getting worse. Thirdly, even if it's not developing an illness or the illness getting any worse, but simply that this illness is going to be prolonged. The recovery from it is going to be prolonged, if that is even the effect of fasting. And there's fear of it that will cause us not to be able to fast. Of course, an illness has got to be something substantial. Otherwise, for example, if you catch a cold, just a regular cold, and you don't take pills for it, the recovery may take a bit longer, maybe. All right. But not fasting because your cold is going to recover a bit later is not a reason to break your fast and take medication for that. Something a bit more serious than just a simple cold. So that's one condition, illnesses. If a person is ill or there's fear of an illness developing, that can be one of those exceptions that a person is not going to fast. Second exception, which is similar but slightly different, is a sister that is either pregnant or a sister who's given birth and she's nursing a child, breastfeeding a child. Either of those, if the fast, again, there's fear of it harming the mother or the child here, that's one of the differences. If there's fear of it harming the child, the same ruling will apply. It would not be allowed for the mother to fast. Now, if the mother is pregnant, the fear that the mother is going to have for the baby that she's carrying, that fear is not something that you can resolve. Now, let's not forget, let me reiterate that the fear has to be substantial, not just fearing, oh my God, something's going to happen to my baby. No, you go to a doctor, if the doctor says that, yes, this can potentially cause problems, and there is fear of that, and it's founded on an expert's opinion, then that fear is something that one can make the choice that they shouldn't fast. But if there is that fear of harm, there's no way to get rid of that fear because we don't have anything that would help us and allow us to fast without addressing, and we're not going to be able to address that fear. But if a mother is breastfeeding a child And they have the fear that if they fast, then because they don't have enough fluids in their body, they're not going to be able to have enough milk to feed the child. There might be alternatives. Okay, you can have alternatives. According to Ayatollah Sistani, and perhaps according to Ayatollah Khamenei as well, as the wording of his ruling is not as clear, but one may reach that conclusion, that if there is an alternative, whether there's another sister that can feed this child, or there is the alternative food that's available that can be provided, that's something that would not allow us to break our fast because we have the fear of not having enough milk. So fear of harm for a mother or her child would be a reason why one cannot fast, is not allowed to fast. And as we mentioned in that particular case, if one can find alternatives, then according to Ayatollah Sistani, it's clear. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, it might be a conclusion that one reaches that it's not a case where we could break the fast. We would have to use the alternatives and go ahead and fast. Recite a salawat, please. As the brothers and sisters know, we've been discussing the lives of the Ahlul Bayt with the objective of learning about what they did, with the objective of speaking of them and seeking the proximity of the Divine through mentioning them, remembering them, talking about them, and most of all, as we mentioned earlier, to learn and through that be able to reach the proximity of the Divine. We've spoken of the Holy Prophet, the Lady Fatimah al-Zahra, and five of the Imams, Salamullah alayhim ajma'in. Tonight, inshallah, we're going to be talking about Imam al-Sadiq, Salamullah alayhi. Imam al-Sadiq lived in a very important time. Some of the things that are usually said about this Imam, let me mention the time or the years of the Imamah of our beloved Imam. Imam al-Baqir became the Imam of the year 95 when Imam Zain al-Abidin was martyred. And he was the Imam until he was martyred in the year 114. And from that point onwards, Imam al-Sadiq is the Imam until the year 138, I believe, if I am not mistaken on that little detail. It's 138 or maybe 137. I am doubtful now, currently, of this, but it's one of those two figures, apparently. So, 2 decades, a bit more than that, is the time and the age of the Imamah of Imam al-Sadiq. One of the things that we know about Imam al-Sadiq is that the majority of our hadith is from Imam al-Sadiq. I think most of the hadith that you've heard, they usually quote who? They quote Imam al-Sadiq, salamullah alayhi. Another thing that sometimes you hear, some of us that maybe have studied a bit more or listened to more lectures, is the reason why this Imam, we have more hadith of him, is that he lived at a time that he could speak more, he was a bit more open, and it was possible for him to do that, as opposed to some of the previous Imams. We talked about the very severe circumstances of the time of Imam Zain al-Abidin, where the Imam could not speak of what he wished to. He had to disguise it in a way where it didn't seem like he's addressing anything that had to do with the political system. You don't even see fiqh being seriously addressed by this Imam, by Imam Zain al-Abidin. Much of what we have of him are du'as, everybody knows, you all know of Sahifa Sajjadiyya. We see Imam al-Baqir, yes, he talks about the knowledge of the Ahlul Bayt, but it's not quite the volume that we see from the sixth Imam, Imam al-Sadiq, salamullah alayh. And when we look at the Imams after him, we again see you don't have the same volume of hadith. So the question comes up, why do we have such a great volume of hadith from this particular Imam? And in fact, his title, As-Sadiq, all right, is something that's related to hadith. Something that is related to hadith. Why? Because he's called the truthful one. Whatever he said the Holy Prophet said this, people would accept that as the saying of the Holy Prophet, as the words of the Holy Prophet. The question is, why did this Imam get to discuss so many topics, explain so many things to the people, as opposed to other Imams? One simple explanation that is given is this, that you have to look at the political scene at the time of Imam al-Sadiq. They say Imam al-Sadiq lived at the end of the Umayyad dynasty, 10 years of the Imam of the Imam, from the year 114 to approximately 124, is when those are the last years of the Khilafah, or the government, the rule of the Umayyads. After that, the rule of Bani al-Abbas begins. So they say, okay, these two dynasties were fighting each other about who's going to have power. Because they were so busy with one another, what did Imam al-Sadiq do? Imam al-Sadiq didn't care about that, in my words. This is not something that I've explicitly heard by scholars or of scholars. But it seems like this. It seems as though two political parties are fighting one another over power, and Imam al-Sadiq sees a golden opportunity to do what? To explain ahkam. The majority of the ahadith we have from Imam al-Sadiq are about ahkam. They're not only about that, but the majority of what we have is about ahkam. So Imam al-Sadiq took the time, took that opportunity, and did this. But this is not a very accurate picture. This is something that I had previously heard. But when you look into it and look at the works of the ulama who have a much better insight into that history and have analyzed it much better, give you a much more complete picture. Let's connect it to what we talked about in the last session when we were discussing Imam al-Baqir, to try to connect this and see how the flow goes. We said from Imam Zainul Abidin salamullah alayhi onwards, there was a movement that was underground in complete secrecy. Imam Zainul Abidin started training companions. He started training believers that would become the ones that gradually become part of the movement of establishing the rule of the Imams. We mentioned that. And along with other things, but we said predominantly in terms of who he dealt with, who he was able to train, who he was teaching, it was small groups, individuals here and there, and he built a number and was able to train a number of these students that were scattered, and they were not only in Medina. But the numbers were few, and the focus of the Imam was only on those who had come a bit closer. At the time of Imam al-Baqir, with the explanations we gave, the Imam decided that he's going to strengthen and expand the network of the Shia and allow it to go further, spread out further, go further east and further west, and also strengthen. The numbers in those regions were going to increase, and they increased. And then the activities, the political activities of the Imam increased. We gave the example of Jabir ibn Yazid al-Ju'fi, one of the companions of Imam al-Baqir. That's one thing he did. The other thing he did was, he didn't focus only on the Shia, the people who accepted the wilaya of the Ahlul Bayt. He started expanding the scope. He started addressing the masses. He started having public sessions, which Imam Zain al-Abidin couldn't have due to his circumstances. And we explain why he did that, because the goal of the Imam was to establish the government of the Ahlul Bayt. And in order to do that in the Islamic Empire, he needed to build the people into better mu'mineen, into real believers, into believers that actually know their faith, know the practical laws to an extent and in a way that they would realize true Islamic teachings do not allow and permit us to live under the government that we are currently living. The Imam wanted to teach the people that. And you needed to have a critical mass to be able to develop that political movement until it would succeed into a revolution. Imam al-Baqir expanded the scope. He started addressing the masses. That's why he's called Baqiru ilm al-Nabiyyin. So by the end of it, what we see by the end of the time, the livelihood of Imam al-Baqir, we see that this movement has matured a lot more than before. There's something that we have maybe less heard of, or if we've heard it, we haven't really paid attention to it. We just mentioned a couple of minutes ago that one of the things about that history of Imam al-Sadiq is that we know that's the time where the Umayyads government fell and the Abbasid government came about. What we don't know, or we know less of, is how the Umayyad government fell and how the Abbasid government came to power. I'll give a couple of facts, historic facts, that I think maybe some of you have heard. And then we'll see how that fits into the rest of the picture, and we'll try to understand what actually happened there. One of the things that we know about the movement of the Abbasids is that one of the centers that had a lot of the supporters of Ben al-Abbas is where? Anybody heard before? It is Khurasan. Okay. There's an individual that is known as Abu Muslim al-Khurasani. And he becomes a general, he becomes a very active part of the Abbasid movement, such that he's able to gather troops, attack palaces of the Umayyads in that region. Gradually, the Umayyads government fell in Khurasan, and then they were able to gradually take over the rest of the Islamic Empire as well, and it took a few years to do that. But where did this start, brothers and sisters? In Khurasan. Who started it? Abu Muslim al-Khurasan. But what was his slogan? How was he able to gather people? How was it that he was able to gather people to come and support who? Ban al-Abbas. Were Ban al-Abbas people that were known at that time? Were Ban al-Abbas people that were respected at that time? How is it that Medina, if you just calculate the distance, Medina, Khurasan, Abu Muslim al-Khurasani, Ban al-Abbas in Medina, where's the connection? What's happened here? Well, when you hear the slogan, you gradually start to realize what actually unfolded. And this is amazing. If we study that history in this way, the way you're going to understand the Ahlul Bayt and what they were able to accomplish, is going to be very different than what we have understood up to this point, up to today. What he was able to gather the people, the slogan he used was what? Was the government of the Ahlul Bayt. Ar-Ridha min Ali Muhammad. Number one. Secondly, do we know what city he started his movement? He started it where the son of Zayd, the son of Imam Zayn al-Abidin. You know, he had an uprising. Zayd had an uprising during the time of Imam al-Sadiq, salamullah alayhi. Okay. And whether or not the Imam accepted it, that's a huge debate. I don't want to talk about that. But he had a son. The son of Zayd escaped. The uprising of Zayd was in Kufa. It was crushed. They fought hard, of course, but it was crushed. They were killed. And the Umayyad governor made an example of him. His body was hanging there for a prolonged period of time. His son escaped, and he went to Khurasan. Why? There seems to be something about love of the Ahlul Bayt in that region. He goes there, he settles, he starts another uprising, which is crushed there. Abu Muslim al-Khurasani goes to that city, and from that city, they begin the movement to go and establish a new government headed by who? By Bani al-Abbas. So the people of Khurasan are trying to establish the government of what? The government of who? The government of Ali Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. How did this come about? Let's look at the history before that and try to analyze. From the day Muawiyah signed the peace treaty with Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, one of the things that we have constantly heard, it's a fact of history, we need to put it in perspective here, is this. It became custom, and it became customary that the khutaba speakers, every Friday and every other speech as well, they would begin their talks with what? Cursing Ali ibn Abi Talib, fabricating lies against him, fabricating lies against Imam al-Mujtaba. It's propaganda, isn't it? If this propaganda machine is bashing who? Ali Muhammad, right? These are Ali Muhammad. The propaganda machine, the official propaganda machine of this empire is bashing Ali Muhammad. Not 1 year, not 2 years, 20 years before Ashura and thereafter. We're talking about the year 114. Close to 60 years after Ashura, add another 20 years, close to 80 years. How many generations is that? What are they hearing publicly? Their speakers. La'an of Ali Muhammad, that's what they're hearing. Okay. So how is it that all of a sudden in Khurasan, you have people that are calling to the government of Ali Muhammad? How did that happen? Some of us would say, Subhanallah. Okay. That's how the love of the Ahlul Bayt is. Miracle. Somehow, out of the blue. Because we have the brothers, I'll just say, Mujiza, va, great, Subhanallah. You know, this is an example of this. With all the bashing, this happened. No, it's not like that, brothers and sisters. There are causes. People have put their lives on the line to make this happen. With all the pressure that the government had in all this false, fabricated ahadith they made against the Ahlul Bayt, that network of the Shia grew, and Imam al-Sadiq had his people spread the love of the Ahlul Bayt, and not only the love of the Ahlul Bayt, the understanding that there's a government of the Ahlul Bayt. There's a government of the Ahlul Bayt. People of Khurasan weren't told this in dreams. Why people of Khurasan? That network had grown. And it wasn't only in Khurasan. In Iraq, in Khurasan, elsewhere. Why were the Abbasids able to do this? Abbasids were not even well known. According to some of the ulama, they hijacked the movement of the Ahlul Bayt. The Ahlul Bayt called to the government of the Ahlul Bayt. People had gotten ready. Now we're starting to understand the circumstances and what Imam al-Sadiq is going to do. So up to this point, what we've explained is this, and this was only an example to show that network of Shia and the public propagation was effective to the extent that it was able to cause people to move and fight and overthrow the Umayyads. This is the work of Imam Zain al-Abidin. This is the work of Imam al-Baqir. This is the work of Imam al-Sadiq, salamullah alayhim ajma'in. Do we understand what that means, brothers and sisters? Do we understand whether it's the wisdom in picking the right strategies, the right tactics? But over the course of close to 60 years, around 60 years, starting a movement and building up until you change a people that are under this type of influence of la'an of the Ahlul Bayt, sab of the Ahlul Bayt, and you gradually build them so they realize the realities and who the Ahlul Bayt are and what they need to do, what people need to do. There were many sacrifices. There were many sacrifices. This was why the Imams were poisoned. This was why the Umayyads were afraid of them. This is why the Abbasids were afraid of the Imams. Because they knew the Imams were active and involved in overthrowing their government. That's why. So what happened? Let's get into some more details about what happened during the time of Imam al-Sadiq, salamullah alayhi. A few important social circumstances that need to be understood. One of them is war. The Umayyads got involved with wars at their borders. That's one element. That doesn't need to be explained much. It's war with kuffar outside of the Muslim borders. At the borders, some of the borders in the east and in the west, in northern Africa, in the east, Central Asia, there were some wars that were being fought. That's one. So the armies and the government, the Khalifa, his mind and his energy is focused on those to an extent. The other thing is two internal elements coming together. One of them is something that we already knew. And that is the way the Umayyads ruled. It was a monarchy. It was a dictatorship. If you don't like something that's happening, if you dare voice your opinion, if you dare speak of a problem that you have with the way things are dealt with, you're going to be crushed. Okay. Dealt with very severely. Nobody has the right to critique anything that the government is doing. That's something that the Umayyads had. They crushed, they killed the companions of the Holy Prophet in Medina, as we mentioned. Why? Because of this. Because the companions voiced their opinion. They cannot tell. They cannot take that. The dictatorship, that's one thing. The other thing, and I think this is important for us to understand in the current context that we live in, I'll explain. The second thing, which is, if we put all three of them together, this will be actually the third, the war with the enemies outside the kuffar, the dictatorship, the style of rule and the style of government, and thirdly, people starting to feel and starting to deal with financial difficulties more and more and more. For various reasons this happened. It's a long story why it happened. That at this time, people started struggling with their finances. Look, one of the rules that we have in society is that if people have their bellies full, if people are not hungry, then the chances of them critiquing and criticizing government is going to be less. If people are living normal lives, if they're not feeling any pressure, the government can do pretty much whatever they want. And as long as you're okay, you're not going to really speak up, or the chances are going to be less. But once you start feeling the pressure, once you start feeling that I don't have enough finances, and then you see the governor have a huge palace, and then every night there's loads of food, the extras we don't even get, all the food that's wasted, all the gold that comes in, people are dying, there's others that are so full, they don't know what to do, they're busting, they have too much. When you see that, then the chances of people wanting to rise up against the government is going to be a lot higher. When you have that, people would like to at least voice their opinion. When they're under pressure, they want to talk about their problems. But you have what? You have the style of government that crushes any type of criticism. You're not allowed to say anything that critiques the government. These three elements mean what? These three elements mean that these people at this time are more prepared for a revolution. People are more prepared for a revolution. So the movement that has progressed this far, the Shias, the political followers of the Ahlul Bayt, their numbers had increased. Their strength had increased, their knowledge increased, their political activism increased. Now it was time to engage in more serious political activism. But it was still not ready for the Imams to set up the type of government that they wanted. Why? As we said, we mentioned this last night. In order for an Islamic government to get set up, you need to have a good percentage of the population want that government. If they choose to have that government, an Islamic government is going to be established. But if a good percentage are not wanting it, and you want to use force to bring that government into power, that will not be an Islamic government. All right. According to a hadith, This movement that started developing by Imam Zainul Abidin, the hadith says that this movement was going to bear its fruits in the year 140, which is a few years after the Shahada of Imam As-Sadiq Salamullah Alayhi. That movement was building up from the year 61, was building up. It was supposed to be the year 140. That's approximately when all of these efforts would have bear their fruit and you would have had an Islamic government. But at that stage, at that time, it was more ready. People could be moved more towards a revolution. But something happened. People that didn't believe in this type of Islamic government and didn't believe in Islamic government at all, they believed in their own government, saw a great and golden opportunity for themselves. Bani al-Abbas. Bani al-Abbas realized, they're in Medina, they realized through attending the sessions of Imam Zain al-Abidin, or the sessions of Imam al-Baqir, and then after that, the sessions of Imam al-Sadiq, they realized the types of people that were coming to the sessions of the Imam, the type of instructions they were getting. It was pretty evident that the Imams were up to something. It was a political movement. They had seen the social readiness that had developed for the government of the Ahlul Bayt. They started, along with some others as well, it's a long story, a number of people within the Ahlul Bayt decided that it was their turn now to take up government and take it from the Umayyads. They saw the weakness of the Umayyads, they saw what the Ahlul Bayt had done, and they prepared the people for the government of the Ahlul Bayt, and they were supposedly, or in some definition of the meaning of Ahlul Bayt, these people could consider themselves the Ahlul Bayt and call people to themselves. For example, some of the children of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba did this, that were not Imams, obviously. They did this. They called to themselves. And obviously the Abbasids also, a number of them, they started having sessions and trying to figure out what they're going to do and how they're going to carry this out. They jumped on the opportunity and they lied. Al-Ridha min Ali Muhammad, that people understood, was the government of the Ahlul Bayt, but they used that. They got Abu Muslim al-Khurasani to get an army together, fight the Umayyads there and take over. And it's interesting, this Abu Muslim al-Khurasani, after establishing the government of the Abbasids, he himself was killed and beheaded by the Abbasids. They only used him to establish their government. When the Abbasids wanted to do this, when the Abbasids started to establish their government, the work of the Ahlul Bayt was being hijacked. One of the things that I want to mention, which is a clear sign of all of what we've been talking about, because some people may still be in denial that the Ahlul Bayt did this type of political activity at their time. Never heard of that. What we've heard is just, you know, prayer, salat, psalm, hajj, these types of things, worship. That's all that we've heard. We haven't heard anything else. Imam As-Sadiq is watching this. The effort that was put in establishing the government of the Ahlul Bayt, that people lost their lives, that people went under and lived through very difficult circumstances, is now being hijacked by people. What did the Imam do? What did the Imam do? Recite salawat, please. The Imam went to Hajj one of those years. It's interesting, one of the things we see in the history of the Ahlul Bayt, and also there's parallels we can draw between that and the coming of our Imam. All of this is connected, brothers and sisters. Let me explain this a bit. There's a word that we refer to the Imam of our times, using that term and that word. And we feel that this word and this term refers to the Imam of our time. What is that word? What is that term? What is that title? It is the Qa'im, Ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. Now it does refer, when we use it, we usually refer to the Imam. But you know what's interesting? They came to Imam al-Baqir before he was martyred. And they asked him who the Qa'im is. Who is the Qa'im going to be? And before I explain what the answer is, I want to draw our attention to this. Why would people even be asking that question? Why would people even be asking who is the Qa'im? In other instances, people would come and ask questions, why aren't you uprising? Why aren't you rising? Why would people come and tell the Imam, why aren't you rising? Who were these people? Again, it shows the active involvement of the Imams in the political scene. But you know what Imam al-Baqir said? He tapped on the shoulder of Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhi and said, he is the Qa'im. Said, he is the Qa'im. The word Qa'im doesn't mean the Imam of our time. There's another hadith, I'll give you that as well. The other hadith says, كلنا قائم. All of us are قائم. It's not like one of us is قائم, the other ones are not قائم. Again, when we hear that, the way we're going to understand it is that, yeah, all of them potentially were going to be قائم. Maybe. Or the type of qiyam that they did was to explain Quran, explain hadith. That's the qiyam they did. The political part, Imam Mahdi ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif is going to do. But that's not the case. The meaning of the word qa'im means the one who's going to rise. That's the meaning of it. The literal meaning of it is that. When Imam al-Baqir says, my son Imam al-Sadiq is going to be the qa'im, it means that he's the one that is going to rise. Not that Imam al-Baqir himself hadn't done that, but it appears based on the connotations that the Imam is trying to say that it is Imam al-Sadiq that will finish the job and he will establish the government of the Ahlul Bayt. That's what the plan was. That's how they were doing this. So what did the Imam do now that he is seeing this effort is being hijacked? What we're about to say is another example that the Ahlul Bayt were fully involved in the social political arena of their time. The Imam went to Hajj, and we wanted to talk about the parallel between the Imam of our time and Imam al-Sadiq. The Imam went to Hajj, he selected that part of the Muslim empire to talk about politics. To talk about politics. To talk about leadership, as I will explain. It's interesting that it says when the Imam of our time comes, where is he going to come from? He's going to go to Mecca. He's going to go from and start from Mecca. But where did the Imam do this? In Arafat. It's interesting. He goes to Arafat. He stands in one direction. He shouts three times. This is Kana Nabi Al Imam. The Prophet was the Imam. What does it mean? What does it mean that the Prophet is the Imam? Remember what we explained about the meaning of the word imamah one of the previous nights? Take that into consideration. The meaning of imam, especially, even if you don't want to accept in the Quran, it means that, which I would completely disagree. At the time of Imam al-Sadiq, most definitely the concept of imamah meant political leadership. The Imam shouts, he says, Kana Nabi al-Imam. The Holy Prophet was the Imam. The Holy Prophet was the political leader. He was the one that led, and he was the one that had the authority. Then he said, after him, it was Amir al-Mu'mineen. After him, Al-Hasan. After him, Al-Husayn. After him, Ali ibn al-Husayn. After him, Imam al-Baqir. And now it's me. It's interesting, we don't have any such statement by the previous imams. We don't have any such statements where the imams would come out publicly in this way. He shouted three times in one direction, turned, shouted another three times in the other direction, turned another three times, turned another three times. We have to correct our understanding of the lives of the Ahlul Bayt. What does this mean? If we don't understand it in the political context, if we don't understand what the Ahlul Bayt had developed up to this point, if I would read this without putting it in context, I would be baffled. How? Because the majority of the people are not Shia. The Imam is going in Hajj season when people go to Arafat. He goes to Arafat. Loads of people that are not Shia, they're not followers of the Ahlul Bayt. The Imam is calling and shouting and saying, I'm the Imam. I'm the Imam, I'm the Imam. The Holy Prophet was the Imam. The Imams after the Holy Prophet, and now I am the Imam. What is the Imam trying to do here? The reason why he does it is because people are prepared. He's prepared them up to that point. He's seeing now people are saying that the Ahlul Bayt that were being spoken of are who? Are Bani al-Abbas. Saying it's Bani al-Abbas, that's the Ahlul Bayt. The Imam says, no, the Ahlul Bayt is not Bani al-Abbas. This is the lineage of Imamah. The lineage of the Imamah after the Holy Prophet, or in fact, he says, beginning with the Holy Prophet, is in this way. The Holy Prophet, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein. People needed to hear that. He was trying to save this movement. This was a very serious political move that the Imam is making here. Very serious move that the Imam is making here. The classes that the Imam was holding, the fiqh that he was explaining, these fiqh classes of the Imam were part of the political movement of the Imam. I think we explained that a bit during the time, or when we were explaining Imam al-Baqir, but I'll explain it and show a different sign for it being very political. What is that? Bani al-Abbas, as we said, they hijacked it. This is what actually happened. The Imams built it up. They took advantage of the time. They said, we are the Ahlul Bayt, al-Ridha min Ali Muhammad, gather troops, overthrow the Umayyad, set up government. Imagine if you would be in that situation. If you had overthrown a government after or using a movement that was set up by who? By somebody else. That was being led by who? By somebody else. And you were able to use that to now come and rule. Who's your biggest enemy? Who's your biggest enemy? The one who was leading that movement that you hijacked. If people would come to realize that the ones that they wanted to rule were not the ones that have taken government now, the whole thing would fall apart. In addition to that, the Abbasids had realized the power of the Ahlul Bayt and these fiqh classes. They realized these fiqh classes of Imam al-Baqir, of Imam al-Sadiq, are leading to the destruction of the Umayyad Empire. They had seen what this can do. Now that they're in power, the first thing they need to get rid of is this enemy. That's why you see that the second half of the life of Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayh is very harsh. When Abu Ja'far Mansur al-Dawaniqi, the second Khalifa of the Abbasids, the first real Khalifa of the Abbasids, when he came to power, he sent Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhi into exile a number of times. Do we know this? Mansur didn't want Imam al-Sadiq to have these classes. He had to push him around, send him here, send him there. He realized he couldn't kill the Imam with all of what he knew. It was very difficult. He couldn't kill the Imam on one hand. On the other hand, you can't let him keep training, keep teaching, keep propagating, because he knows that these classes are where all those companions come and that political movement is going to continue. The network of the Shia is strong here. This is the leader. He sent him into exiles. Once, twice, three or four times the Imam was sent into exile. Different parts, different locations. The fiqh class even of the Imam was this. But then once the Ahlul Bayt saw that this effort did not succeed, then the strategy of the Ahlul Bayt changes after this. But one last point, I apologize for taking too long. One last point I think is important. It's important. What happened that caused this problem? That's something that we need to spend some time analyzing after just knowing these facts that were thrown out. For the first time we hear them, we've got to try to digest them and try to analyze what happened, what caused this. We have one statement from the Ahlul Bayt themselves about this. One statement of the Ahlul Bayt, which I won't explain much. I feel because it was taking too long, there were points that I didn't explain, some of the things that can relate to the current setting, the current circumstances we are in, especially in this country. Try to think of it yourself and see if you can draw parallels. But the reason why the Ahlul Bayt said this failed, this effort failed, is, in the words of the Ahlul Bayt, إِضَاعَ. What does that mean? It means people not being able to keep secrets. People not being able to keep secrets. What does that mean? That means a lot. That means the believers that were part of the movement in where the Islamic movement succeeded, they can tell you what that means. Brothers and sisters were imprisoned. They were tortured to release names. Who are the people that are involved in the movement? In the Islamic Revolution, go read their stories. I visited the facilities that these people were tortured and the stories of how these people were tortured. There was this brother, they have a statue of him there, kind of showing how he was. They had tied him to a bed for 6 months. 6 whole months. And they would beat him on his feet until it would bleed every day. Just to release names. They wouldn't. People have lost lives. They kept secrets. They were able to keep secrets of the movement, and that's what caused it to succeed. The companions of the Ahlul Bayt, some of them, unfortunately, they didn't keep those secrets. And one of the ways, and this is very important, again, there's various reasons why, I will leave it up to you to see what the implications of that are, or what the implications of that message are going to be in our lives today. But one of the very important principles, one of the reasons that would cause one or allow one to be able to keep those secrets or not to be able to keep them, is taqwa. Taqwa. Not committing sins. Fulfilling the wajibat. Till the iman strengthens. It takes a lot of faith, brothers and sisters. It takes a lot of faith to be able to take all that punishment and not give in, not release names. In this country, there is actually no movement, honestly. Are you guys, any of you part of any political movement here? I'm not. I don't know if you guys are. After 9/11, people were visited by the FBI. They didn't release information. Some of them fabricated information about others. Yeah, this guy, you know, he's connected to this organization or the other organization, and so on and so forth. People were imprisoned. I don't want to talk about specific examples. People were imprisoned because of the misinformation that was given to the FBI. The guy is so scared, they ask him all the possibilities, all the imaginations even that he has of what actually happened, thinking that this person was involved with this group or the other, are going to some agent somewhere. Lies and fabrications. It takes a lot of faith, it takes true iman to be part of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt. And we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to allow us to have that. Assalamu alaykum. Ya Ahla Bayt al-Nubuwah wa mawdi'a ar-risalah wa mukhtalaf al-malaika ومهبط الواحي وخزان العلم ومنتهى الخلم. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you, my beloved Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you. It was in your homes that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blessed us with guidance and revelation. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you, angels descend upon you day in and day out, seeking permission before entering upon you. صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله يا جعفر بن محمد أيها الصادق Let's visit again Medina tonight. The lonely graves of the Ahlul Bayt. Hoping and praying for the time we would be able to have a shrine built for the Ahlul Bayt in Medina. The Shia could gather. You know, when you really feel the loneliness of the A'imma in Baqi'i, when you go to Mashhadur Rida, the beautiful shrine of Imam al-Rida, we call Imam al-Rida Ghareeb al-Ghuraba. But O Imam Rida, your shrine is always full of people. Even the pigeons that come to your shrines will find a place. But in Medina, most nights, every night, there is no one that can visit the graves of the A'imma in Baqi'i. Maybe a maximum, a total of an hour, sometimes in the mornings, they open the gates, the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt run up those gates to see the graves of the Ahlul Bayt. I don't know what it is with Medina, although it's the city of the Ahlul Bayt, when you enter it, you feel lonely. Historically, many things have happened in this city. Medina saw a day that the Mal'un, the Khalifa, Mansur al-Dawaniqi, told the governor of Medina, set the house of Ja'far ibn Muhammad on fire. Brothers and sisters, can you imagine? The house of your beloved Imam is set on fire while he's in the house. How did the women and children feel in the house? But brothers and sisters, I feel maybe if Imam al-Sadiq saw that fire in his house in Medina, maybe he remembered and felt how it was when they put the door of the house of Amir al-Mu'mineen on fire. Maybe he remembered his mother at that point. Maybe he felt how it felt to be in that house, how Zainab, Imam al-Husayn, Imam al-Mujtaba felt in that house when it was set on fire. Sallallahu alayka ya Mawlai. But ya Mawlai, when Imam al-Sadiq was poisoned, brothers and sisters, the body of the Imam was buried with dignity and respect. لا يومك يومك يا أبا عبد الله. It wasn't enough to behead the Imam. It wasn't enough that the Imam had 300 wounds on his body. The Mal'oon said on the eve, the afternoon of Ashura, he said, who would like to volunteer by putting new horseshoes on their horses? When they volunteer, they say, what shall we do? He said, I want you to trample the body of the Shuhada. No wonder when Zainab came to the body to find her brother, she had a difficult time finding her brother's body. And when she finally saw it, she said, "Anta akhi, are you my brother?" ألا لعنة الله على القوم الظالمين وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون اللهم إنا نسألك وندعوك باسمك العظيم الأعظم الزهراء وأبيها وبعلها وبنيها السر المستودع فيها بك يا الله 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 يا رحمن يا رحيم يا مقلب القلوب ثبت قلوبنا على دينك وعلى محبة أوليائك. O Allah, we ask you to hasten the return of our Imam. We ask you to help us become his true companions, his followers, those who give everything in his way. O Allah, prolong the life of and protect all those helping the cause of Islam, especially the Maraj, especially our beloved leader. O Allah, forgive us all of our sins. Forgive our parents, our grandparents, our relatives, all believers, those who are alive, those who passed away. Ya Allah, we all have hajat. We have needs, we have requests. We know people who have hajat, they're under difficulties, suffering from hardships and difficulties. Some of us here are ill. We know others who are suffering from illnesses throughout the globe. Ya Allah, we ask you, by the right and the truth of Imam al-Sadiq, that you grant all the ill the cure they need, that you grant all believers the request they have, relieve all of them from the hardships they're facing. Ya Allah, especially our brothers and sisters in Iraq, with the tough circumstances they're in, we ask you to eradicate the problem that exists in Iraq, so that we see the brothers and sisters relieved of this pain and hardship. Ya Allah, relieve all the people of the world of the oppressions they're facing. Min Nabiyyi wa Alih, Rahimallah, Man Qara'a al-Fatihata Ma'as-Salawat.